Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Psychosocial Distancing Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Daniel Chadbourne, and with me, as always, are Thomas Brooks.
Hello, hello.
And Alyssa Jones.
Hi, everyone.
And joining us for a discussion on memory, cognition, metacognition, is Amanda Stevens.
Hi.
Oh, it's so nice to have you here talking with us. We normally tell our guests that we're probably terrible at introducing anyone. I'm usually bad at introducing myself. And so we let our guests kind of give us the background. So we'll let you introduce yourself, who you are, what you do, what your research interests are, whatever else you'd like to share with us.
Sure. First, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here. I'm Amanda Stevens. I am a doctoral candidate in Texas right now. My degree will say educational psychology, but most of what I've done is closer to cognitive experimental psychology. So since I've been working on my PhD, I've been coordinating the memory and cognition lab on campus, where we study memory and cognition. These days we study a lot more metacognition than we did when I first started. When I first started, we kind of like did a lot of false memory stuff and stuff in that area, but these days it's pretty metacognition focused. I have three cats who I love very, very much, and I'm very allergic to.
Oh, no.
And I really like summer, and I'm hating the time change right now.
Fair.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say don't feel bad about your educational psych degree. Technically, your diploma does not say educational psychology. At least mine doesn't.
Okay, I trust.
Yeah.
We have a running joke that by the time we're done with this podcast, we're going to have interviewed every single person at A&M Commerce.
We have gone through most of the psychology department at this point, and then we have started branching out.
Start with what you know.
Exactly. Like if we've got contacts, that's who we're going to exhaust first before we move on to anyone else. And we have tried, to our credit. We still have not gotten Noam Chomsky on the podcast.
Oh, keep trying. I'm sure you've got a few years while he's alive.
Right? We've got to get him while he's still good. So you mentioned that your lab is currently studying metacognition. And so I was wondering if you could kind of give us a like introduction to what metacognition is and why do we care about it, I guess.
Sure.
What is it? How is it different than just regular cognition?
Okay. That's a good way to kind of juxtapose it. Like, so regular cognition are the processes that are involved in thinking and problem solving and, you know, language production and stuff like that. Metacognition is just really tuning your attention to those processes. So like the most basic definition is thinking about your own thinking or just paying attention to what's going on in your head or your heart. You can also turn metacognition towards emotion as well. Yeah, so we can kind of break down metacognition into like a few different components. You've got the monitoring aspect, which is really what I just described. It's just being aware of your cognitive processes and paying attention to them. And then you've got metacognitive knowledge, which really has to do with knowing what works for you and what doesn't. So for example, like knowing what strategies work, when certain strategies should be used, stuff like that. And then you have the control component of metacognition, which is deciding to do something with that information. So I should probably write this down because I'm not going to remember it later. Or, you know, I should probably study this information a bit longer because I don't think I know it as well as the other stuff. Mm. So it's important to study for, especially for students, but also just for, you know, outside the classroom. We, of course, in my lab, we study it with students because it's a college campus. And so it's a sample of convenience. But it's easy to kind of illustrate why metacognition is important when you think about a student population. Metacognition or metacognitive skills are basically learning skills. You learn what works for you, what doesn't work for you, when I should study, how long I should study for, what should I study, where should I study in somewhere quiet or am I okay to study, you know, with my friends or something like that? So to give an example of maybe why it's especially important for students, you can think about a student who is like overconfident in their performance. And overconfidence is a form of metacognitive bias, in at least in this context. So a student who's overconfident in their performance, they're probably not going to study adequately for an exam or put enough time into assignments that they should, right? Because if they think they're going to ace a class, why would they put in extra time and effort to, you know, get a few extra points? Versus a student whose metacognition is more calibrated to their realistic performance. But beyond the classroom, this of course applies to everybody. You can think about mindfulness as kind of an offshoot of metacognition. So just being mindful of your internal processes and how you react to the world around you. If you're conscious of those things, you can kind of learn to react more so how you would like to react instead of just reacting, right? You can have more control over your reactions to the world. In general, like understanding your own strengths and limitations is important for everybody. So going back to that example about, you know, maybe I should write this down because I'm not going to remember it later. We've all had that experience where you fully believe somebody's telling you something and you fully believe I'm going to remember that. And then you turn around or blink and it's gone. So just being more metacognitively aware of your own strengths and limitations can help you to maybe avoid those types of situations or reduce them. There's also some research that metacognition might be related to empathy. So once you are able to really understand your own cognitive processes and your own reactions, you can kind of project that onto other people's thought processes and consider that, and maybe be a little bit more tolerant of how people react to you or to other situations.
So it's kind of like a intersection between metacog and like theory of mind.
Yeah. I don't know a whole lot about that particular, you know, subsection of metacognition, but there are people out there doing that work for sure.
Do you mind telling us about one or more projects that you've been working on, maybe now or in the past, that has to do with metacognition, or even something that might be tangentially related?
I would love to share that.
Okay, yeah.
Go for it. Yeah, so currently we're working on a project where we're looking at judgments of learning and emotional text. So a judgment of learning is basically a form of, it's a specific instance of metacognitive monitoring. So you're judging an item, you are presented with some kind of stimulus and you're asked to judge how likely you are to remember that later. So that's the essence of what a judgment of learning is. Typically these are made on a 0 to 100% probability scale. So I'm 80% sure I'm going to remember this. I'm, 10% sure I'm going to remember this, anything in between. And there's evidence showing that people tend to give higher judgments of learning for emotional items. So our study is kind of looking at why is that the case? And the two potential explanations that we're trying to pit against each other, is it a metacognitive belief? So do people just have this belief that emotional items ought to be remembered better? Therefore, I'm going to say that I'm going to remember more of them. Or is it something about the ease with which these emotional items are processed? Are they just quicker to process, easier to process, and therefore people use that information to base their judgment of learning on? So that's what we're doing at the moment, or that's one of the studies that we're conducting at the moment. In the past, on my master's thesis, I looked at reactivity to judgments of learning. So a reactive effect means that the act of engaging in that process affects a process downstream. And there's some evidence suggests that making a judgment of learning can enhance your memory for that information later on. So in these studies, you have a judgment of learning condition and then a control condition where learners don't make those judgments and you compare their memory performance. The evidence on these effects it's kind of spotty. We find it in some conditions, other times we don't find it. In my thesis, we found it only in one condition. So what we did is we did several experiments trying to see if we could find this effect. Where we found it was where we had lists of categorized words. So you get words like pig, bear, donkey, you know, they're all animals. And instead of judging each item, you would wait until the whole list had been presented and give what's called a global JWL. So you ask the learner, how many of these items do you think you'll remember later? And under those conditions, we found the reactive effects. So our ad hoc explanation was that maybe that global judgment of learning, like considering how the words, like maybe your people are using the relationship between those words to base that judgment on. And therefore you're kind of like giving that relationship more attention, or you're processing it even deeper. And then later when you're asked, how many animals did you recall, or how many animals can you remember? That's what's called a cued recall test. So cued recall benefits from what we call relational processing. Extracting or bringing to mind what those items had in common, and then the like specific items start popping up in your mind. So that's a couple of metacognitive things that we've been doing.
So the category almost acts like a scaffold then to like organize those items.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you kind of get, our idea was that you get like a transfer appropriate processing effect, where the processing required to recall those words is more similar to the processing required to make that judgment. So in both cases, it's beneficial to use that relationship between the words.
Interesting.
So just to be clear, just so I understand, you're saying that when you make the JOL or the judgment of learning, you're engaging in the relational processing, which also then later enhances retrieval because of you engaging in the same type of processing of the relational.
Right, aspects. Right. Okay. So specifically we use cued recall, which also benefits from relational processing. There are other types of processing, and different tests are going to be sensitive to different types of processing. But that was our idea, is that, okay, this cued recall test is, from past research, you know, it seems that that type of recall is sensitive to relational processing.
So one of the kind of themes that have been emerging out of this season with cognition is kind of this line to walk between the basic research, the basic theoretical research, and then like the hyper applied aspects of cognition and memory. And so metacog kind of sits on that line a little bit. Could you kind of talk with me about how you negotiate the theoretical aspects and the practical aspects of your research? Because those tend to be a couple different camps with different like research norms and expectations and things like that. So what is that like, being situated so closely on that line between the two?
Sure. So I will say that the topic of metacognition does seem to kind of sit there in the middle, but you also still have the camps. So you have basic cognitive researchers doing this type of research, and you also have educational psychologists doing this type of research. And so the educational psychologists are going to apply these concepts in a more, of course, applied way, whereas the basic cognitive psychologists are going to try to get at those basic processes underneath. But you do have, there's a lot of, or at least recently, there's a lot of talking back and forth between these camps. They kind of seem to be working together these days. So this brings to mind, there's a whole body of literature on self-regulated learning, which is, it really is more like the go-between between like the basic versus applied stances on this. So the idea behind self-regulated learning is that students use metacognition among other skills that they develop to regulate their own learning processes. Which, I mean, it sounds exactly like what I've been talking about, but it's more, these studies are typically done like in the classroom, you know, like more ecologically seated And then you have like the super applied stuff. So like the mindfulness research that's coming out, that's kind of like the hyper applied aspect of metacognitive research.
Right. Yeah. No, that was, I've brushed up against the mindfulness research a little bit with the trauma research. And so I was like, ooh, look at that connection.
Yeah, that's cool.
I've just been silent. I've just been taking it all in. It's new. I mean, metacognition, bringing up mindfulness is a really good example, because I remember right as it was burgeoning in terms of like really not just like getting into the research, but starting to kind of get into public consciousness, I would have students want to do research on mindfulness. And I'd be like, all right, what's mindfulness? And they'd be like, oh, well, it's, I don't. And I was like, I need someone to explain it to me at this point. And then finally kind of getting some context where someone who I think did the research and did some understanding, I was like, yeah, it's being aware of these processes. And it's very metacognitive. Like, it's sort of the way that this kind of bridged the gap between those topics for me, or at least cognition and then the mindfulness, the benefits of mindfulness.
Yeah, there's a lot of exciting. I mean, yeah, you're totally right that it's like, you know, bursting at the moment as far as public consciousness goes. Mm-hmm. It's a big deal right now.
I was going to say that in a lot of my classes, I've found, so right now I'm teaching an intro to psych course, two sections of that, and then also two sections of cognitive psychology at an undergraduate level. And I keep finding in a lot of the chapters, this re-emphasis on, or an emphasis on, mindfulness. And I was just wondering if you knew about any specific studies that really truly could demonstrate or represent the difference between mindfulness compared to metacognition, but also how they're maybe correlated or pretty much the same thing in some ways.
It's a good question. As far as specific research goes, I'm not coming up with anything. But I think in general, like the same processes that are occurring with a student who's being metacognitively aware are also occurring when somebody's being mindful. Okay, so it's all about where you're turning your attention. And anything metacognitive based is inward attention, right? You're paying attention to what's going on internally, which is exactly what mindfulness is as well. It's an attempt to actually observe what's going on internally before reacting.
Okay. Yeah, I was showing my students a video from a Netflix documentary actually called The Mind Explained. But they were talking about how students, or at least college participants, if they engaged and took part in a mindfulness workshop, that there was a significant increase in their GRE scores. And so I would probably, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, associate that somewhat to do with mindful metacognition to a degree, where they're able to recognize what they know and what they don't know, but also are able to enhance their ability to focus on the things or the tasks at hand that they need to focus on in order to get the task done. Would you say that that's on the verge of what was going on in that study?
Yeah, that sounds like it to me.
Yeah.
Having greater awareness of, you know, what I know, what's going on internally. And if you have greater awareness of it, ideally you are better able to control what you do after that. You know, so whether you focus on this particular type of information, or whether you react or you stop and breathe, you know, if you're thinking about like outside the classroom, in an interpersonal setting, you know, being mindful, but also just having those basic metacognitive skills should ideally help you to better process and consider your next behaviors, your next actions, instead of just reacting.
It could also be a circumstance, particularly with like the GRE, if you give students tools to self-regulate and calm and center, that in the middle of the test, when they start to panic because the GRE is terrible, as we've talked about on this podcast before, if you can center yourself and not think about the consequences of how well you do or the fact that the test is out to get you, and you can just focus on problem, and go algorithmically rather than get all existential about your GRE test, I'm sure it helps your score on the GRE.
I mean, I'm not going to blame my first time taking the GRE on the fact that my brakes went out on the way there. But it's a great excuse for why I didn't do as well as I wanted to. But that anxiety played a huge difference. I think the second time was because I knew what to expect, I think, a lot better. So I can't even tell if it was just additional time studying, knowing what to expect, or, you know, again, like I've already, you know, I'm in a much less anxious state. And if you're calm from some mindfulness training.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that's a good example. You know, there's research with people who have like generalized anxiety disorder, and, you know, engaging in mindfulness practices seems to help, but test anxiety is a specific form of anxiety, right?
I would just speak a word of caution to listeners about like the relationship between mindfulness and traumatic experiences. The jury still seems to be out in that regard. Because as you go inward, you start revisiting awful experiences. And so that may not necessarily reduce anxiety in that particular case. Like general anxiety or test anxiety, absolutely. But if we're looking at like people who've experienced trauma, you want to have like a super controlled area with like people around you who like care about you and know what's going on before you breach into a mindfulness session.
It's a very good point.
So I guess to get back into your area, you are like right on the cusp within this dissertation phase right now. Typically we ask guests, you know, like, what does the field look like for undergraduates who might be listening to this right now who want to go into metacognition or self-regulated learning? What will their dissertations look like in, you know, 4 to 8 years? And so if you could kind of speak to your experience, like trying to, I guess, dissertate within metacognition and kind of where you see the field going in the future, like in the short-term future.
Sure. I think metacognition, like a lot of fields right now, are becoming more welcoming to other disciplines and other areas of expertise. So I think that in the future, and it's happening right now, you're seeing studies that are coming out that are, you know, you get an educational psychologist and a cognitive psychologist that collaborate on a project. So you're kind of, instead of just focusing on that one little corner of the picture, you're zooming out a bit and including multiple perspectives. So I think that's really, and I think that a lot of academia is hopefully going in that direction, and metacognition just the same. So I predict maybe closer to more applied studies coming out, more like in the classroom type experiments. As we all know from doing, you know, or learning about or doing some applied research, it's difficult for its own reasons, but I think the more that these camps work together, we can just learn from each other and learn how to take these basic processes and look at them in a more seated environment.
Very cool. So they need to make friends with their education major peers and go to grad school with them.
Yes, absolutely. Hopefully you'll find a department where those are right next to each other in the same college, you know? Yeah, it makes it easier.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, playing off of all that, just because I'm curious, is that what you see yourself doing in the future, Amanda? Or do you have more of a passion for basic versus applied? Because, you know, it's all worthwhile. Everything is needed and everything is useful, but there's definitely benefits from the interdisciplinary aspects of coming together between basic and applied, but also the different subfields. But I mean, I think I'm just curious as to see like what you're actually interested in pursuing, because you're one of the ones who are actually in the field.
Yeah, I'm definitely interested in pursuing a more applied approach. So far in my degree, I haven't had a whole lot of opportunity to do so. One of my potential research questions for my dissertation was going to be like much more applied. But as you all know, a good project is a done project. So for the purposes of dissertation, I'll probably stick closer to what I'm used to. But I'm very passionate about learning. I'm very passionate about education and students and learning in general. So I would ideally have the freedom to move in that direction in the future.
I'm excited to see what you do. I've gotten a secret preview a little bit. Oh, just working with Sarah.
Oh, got you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm super excited about that, by the way.
Yeah, no, I'm very excited to like get you in a new applied area. I think
yeah, me too. Yeah, good experience.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping a year that applied in-person research is a little easier too.
Right, because there are limitations on like, well, I guess not in Texas. She can do all the applied research she wants.
Wait, I'm confused.
We're talking about COVID.
Oh, okay. Okay. Right. Yeah. Texas, yeah, maybe Texas and Florida.
Yeah.
I mean, we're seeing that now with the issues where we have clinical master's students here and they're working on kind of either readapting or finding ways to, you know, with these safety measures, like these extra considerations that we have to take. But some of it has been really fascinating, especially with engaging in like mindfulness, for one, with a student who just successfully defended her thesis, who focused on bringing people into outside spaces. And while like, quite fine what they were looking for, they still found a marked effect regarding the people who engaged in the therapy versus didn't, even digitally. It was still, you know, quite effective at engaging in, you know, some level of, whether it be outside or not, seems to have some benefit.
Wow. Even digitally, do you mean like they were engaged in like a VR situation?
They were all on Zoom. Like they were being directed through Zoom in this case.
Okay.
Yeah, that would be the next step. And it's been, I do know someone here at New Mexico Highlands who had talked about doing that, putting people in digital outdoor spaces versus like cityscapes and seeing how that affects a number of different things. And I really need to get him to do that.
Cool. That's really cool. Yeah.
But adding something like a metacognitive component would be really interesting to that.
Yeah, yeah.
We didn't ask you to prepare this, but could you give us some metacognitive tips for learning that you've picked up along the way through your research? What seems to help and what seems to hurt?
Sure. I'll start with what seems to hurt, because there are a lot of strategies out there that people think work. But don't. So a good example is just restudying a piece of information. It's better than, you know, not looking back at it at all. But comparatively, if you test yourself on information, you're going to see a much greater boost in performance than just restudying something. But students don't seem to, or learners don't often appreciate that boost. You know, we all know what cramming is all about personally and, you know, from observing our students. They still do it, even if you teach them, you know, that distributing that practice is going to be better for you. It's a stubborn one. It's a stubborn one to eradicate or to work with. Highlighting text doesn't seem to do a whole lot. If anything, it's kind of like studying the definitions in a chapter, but missing out on the concepts. You know, it's kind of like, it kind of leads you to focus on like the definitional aspects of what you just read versus the synthesis of information. So some better strategies. Summarizing is great. So as you're reading a passage or as you're, I know I keep applying this to the classroom, but that's what I work with. Yeah. But as you're reading something, pausing after, you know, a paragraph or a section or something, and forcing yourself to summarize it in a sentence or two, that's a great strategy because it allows you to process the underlying meaning, right? Instead of just memorizing the words that were there. Like I said, distributed practice of testing yourself is great. Really just trying to incorporate metacognitive checks is helpful. Just the act of pausing every once in a while and asking yourself, do I know this? You know, could I teach this to somebody? Just the act of like having those little checks in the study session helps. And that leads me to teaching somebody. If you can teach it, you know it. So if you can tie down somebody who, you know, will let you try to teach them, then that's a great strategy as well. I've had students that have expressed that they do that, which is beautiful. Sometimes it's time consuming, so I understand why students don't always engage in that practice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You mentioned at the top that it's kind of the overconfidence in people who aren't calibrated. Could you kind of, what is calibration and how do I do that?
Sure. Calibration is one way that we can measure the accuracy of your metacognition. So with calibration, you can be miscalibrated in either direction. So you can be overconfident in your judgments that you're making, your metacognitive judgments, or you can be underconfident. So overconfident would, to illustrate, would be like a student expecting to ace a class where they barely skate by with a 70 or something. Whereas an underconfident student, you know, is probably going to think that they're not performing very well when they actually got the highest grade in the class. And we see that pattern. Typically the less well-performing students, if you will, are overconfident, and the top students tend to be underconfident in their performance. So how can we get better calibrated? In the basic literature, there's a lot of research out there on metacognitive interventions and if they help. But really just trying to engage in these strategies that I mentioned before. So testing yourself, adding these metacognitive checks into your study sessions and stuff like that, those should help you to better calibrate your expectations with your actual performance, because you're just taking the time to consider, how well do I know this, you know, and instead of just assuming, oh, I've got this. So
that's fair.
Yeah.
I have a question for you, because I completely agree with you in terms of trying to get students to understand that cramming doesn't work, while distributed practice and practice testing seems to work the best, especially considering how much research backs that. Do you have any tips, and it's okay if you don't, but do you have any tips on how to get it through to students that this works? I mean, other than just trying to get them to do practice testing in class, trying to work with them to do distributed practicing. I mean, that's the only thing that I can find to try to get it across to them. But it's something that's hard to drill into them. Just like you said, it's hard to get them to see the benefits. Even when you try to explain how memory works and why that's the case, it just seems that maybe they're just so overworked. Maybe they're just, you know, in that kind of situation that comes with being an undergrad, where they don't practice what we're preaching enough to actually see the benefits. But maybe you, and if like I said, if you don't have any advice, it's totally okay. But if there's any possible like exercises or ideas that you have that you've read about, that would be much appreciated, because I struggle with my students trying to describe all this to them. Like, they hear it, they understand it, but then they don't practice it. And it's just a dilemma. It's just, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if I have any like magic advice. Because we know how it is to be students, you know, sometimes you sacrifice the best strategy for the adequate strategy, you know, the more time effective strategy. And I think that's what's going on with most students. They hear this information, but when it comes down to it, they have their reasons for choosing X strategy versus Y. You mentioned stuff you can do in the classroom. I know that that's kind of time consuming on the instructor's part, but even just like requiring them to keep a journal where you incorporate metacognitive checks into the journal. And you don't have to grade the journal. You can, you know, it can be like a pass fail thing or an extra credit thing. But the act of, for one, you're implementing those metacognitive checks. But if you go even further and, you know, add like reflection questions in the journal, that's of course going to enhance those metacognitive skills even more. And ideally the students would be able to observe the boost in performance that they get from that. You know, you also have to be aware of that you're improving. But ideally students would notice that. Nice. But I mean, you're right that it's difficult because a lot of these things are time consuming, or they're just more difficult, you know. A lot of things that are more difficult actually lead to better learning and better memory. But students don't want to hear that. People don't want to hear that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even if they want to hear it, they don't want to engage in it, which I totally understand.
Yeah.
But no, that helps a lot. I've never really thought about working in metacognitive journals, and I might do that next semester, because you're right. Just allowing it to be on their own time and it be a pass fail thing, but giving them the option to see their own improvement, which would reinforce the better, you know, learning strategies, studying skills. That's all I want for them. You know, I want them to learn how to use these skills so that it doesn't just work in my classroom, that it works in all the classrooms and also outside of the classroom. So that's a really good idea. I'm going to look into that. So thank you.
I like that.
I'll send you some studies.
That's awesome. Yeah. Thank you.
I like that expansive view. I've been, since the pandemic started, maybe kind of moving online, I've been trying to figure out like, how do I get my students engaged? And also, how do I shift from not just lecturing out the book or kind of doing my standard lecture? And so I've been trying to balance some lecture with asking my students for every chapter to give me two questions that they have about the text. So what is something they read and they didn't understand? And I tried this with one of my classes last fall, and it worked really well. And I regretted not doing it for even like the research methods class. And I kind of regret not doing it for my research methods class this semester. I should have been doing it again. But it worked really well for my social psych class, my memory and cognition class last spring, and even my statistics course. They kept me on my toes, too, because they were pulling questions from the text that I wasn't even kind of thinking were important. But they were like, we need to know what this means. And I'd be like, all right, I got to go back and reread, double check, and make sure I've got an answer for them in class. And so it kind of worked out that I think they got more out of the class, because I would just go in and it's kind of like a no pressure. So that way they didn't have to announce it in class. They didn't have that anxiety that comes with being that person who has to speak up. And so I'd come to class with a list of questions. I'd be like, all right, this person's question was really good. This is what it's about. And be able to go into it a little more in depth. And I think that helped them, that because they kind of got to reassess, what do I want to know more? What do I need to know more about? What don't I understand versus what do I understand? I think I was unwittingly making them engage in some metacognition with that.
It sounds like it. I think that's a fantastic idea. And on the instructor's part, it's really not that intensive, right? I mean, if you're emotionally invested in your student outcomes, then you're probably happy to do something like that anyway.
Yes. I will say they raked me over the coals in that stats course, because it was like an undergraduate stats course. And there were a couple of times I went in and I'm like, whoever came up with this question, but I'm going to answer it. And I went and looked it up, and I spent an hour doing research on it. But also, it's not going to be on the test.
Yeah. Stats would be a difficult one because there's so much, like, I feel like a lot of times I would be like, just wait. Like, just wait, and I promise it'll be explained later. You're not ready to understand. You know what I mean? You don't need to know that right now.
Yeah, and it was good to bring that up, too, in class, because there were things. I was like, we're going to cover that next chapter. We're going to cover that in a couple of chapters. Like, we're going to get to that. Don't worry about that. You know, like, or think about it. Keep it in your mind. But it was good because I think for those students, they were thinking about it. They were thinking about it now. And so when it came up again later, we were able to kind of tie it back to those previous discussions. And they were at least aware of those gaps of what was next. What was the next step? What do they maybe need to know? And yeah, no, it was enjoyable for me, I will say. But it was like they kept me on my toes. It was work in that class. More work than usual.
Sure. Well, that sounds like a great idea. I wish I were teaching next semester so I could try that out for myself.
Yeah.
But I'm also glad to take a break on teaching that school too.
And it's a good balance between grading because it was pretty easy to grade. It was very just, did you turn in your questions? Did you not? But also it gave me a lot of feedback on like, what holes can I fill? What gaps can I get into as well? And what do the students want to talk about? You know, they could leave out anything that just didn't seem interesting. And we could hone in on the stuff that they found a little more interesting in those classes. So yeah, I need to get back on track with that and not take it out of my class because we're going back in person.
Sounds like it caused you to engage in some metacognitive exercises about teaching.
Every semester. All I think about is what am I not covering? What am I not covering enough? And whatever answer I come up with, it's wrong. There's always something else, or there's always a curveball that gets thrown my way. But yeah, it keeps things interesting.
There's a small body of literature out there on teacher metacognition too, like how aware are teachers at what type of teaching styles are effective, or what concepts to focus on and stuff like that. So yeah, you inadvertently did that to yourself.
Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating too. I was reading something where, and I need to go find the citation because it was sort of like a citation needed statement about the amount of decisions and kind of these like quick decisions that teachers make, like the amount of cognitive load that they go through on a daily basis. And so like being really good at being aware of those things and like being able to balance yourself, like engaging in some metacognition is probably very beneficial, because I think about me, you know, in class for an hour and 45 minutes or an hour and 15 minutes, and then also like an elementary school teacher who's in class for like 6 hours
all day. Yeah.
I know. Yeah. I'm exhausted after two classes back to back. I so feel for my kids' teacher.
Yeah, I can't imagine, because it's so draining, you know, just giving a single lecture is draining.
So we are at 7 o'clock.
We did it.
I guess I should end or get us close to the end with our bias of the week. I keep waiting because Thomas normally really emphatically like celebrates the bias of the week. But whenever we have a guest on, he's like, I gotta stay professional. I'm not going to get really excited about the bias of the week. And every time, I never know what's going to happen.
I got to keep you on your toes.
I'm always thinking about, yes, because I have to pause. And I'm like, am I just pausing today? And it just seems awkward.
Well, we fill it in with a jingle.
I figure we're at the end. Yes. Yeah. I will add a little jingle when we say the bias of the week. And I'll add a second one with that second time I said it. So all this season, we've been doing cognitive biases, specifically biases by Kahneman and Tversky, because they've got like a dozen of them. Unfortunately, I am at my last Kahneman and Tversky bias that I have on our list. This is like the 14th. And I don't know if it really, like, maybe we could try to find a way to connect it. We'll engage in some metacognitive thinking about our own thinking and how we engage in biases to try to apply this to our topic this our topic this week. But it's hot hand fallacy. It's the last one I've got. And it's actually not Kahneman and Tversky. It's Gilovich, Vallone, and Tversky. So it's, I'm scraping the bottom of the barrel with these.
Diet Kahneman and Tversky.
Yes. Yeah. And it's like 10 years after the other ones we've been talking about. So it's the false belief that a person who has experienced success with a random event has a greater chance of further success and additional attempts. I mean, it is very similar to we talked about gambler's fallacy last week, which is, this is basically gambler's fallacy light. Like a specific side of it.
It does sound like what Amanda was talking about with regards to overconfident students. So I did great in intro to psych. I'm going to be a psych major because psychology is the thing that's going to be easy for me to do. And then they show up in y'all's stats and methods classes. Oh. Like, what did I get myself into?
I had someone who came the first day and they were like, I'm going to drop this course. This is too confusing.
Oh, no.
I'm like, we just talked about what a research paper was. Uh-oh. Yeah, I see the same thing with like the post-high school. Like that's the one big thing I think that students have the most trouble integrating from high school to college is that the way you study and the way you can get through a high school class and the way your teachers engage with you is so different. So you have this idea that success in a high school class is going to translate to greater success in the future. I mean, I could even apply it to like the people who are doing really well in high school and then they go to college and they're like, oops. Like even popularity wise or just social wise, and suddenly that success does not translate to the future. Just because you did great on one thing doesn't mean it's gonna.
I mean, I think Amanda can probably speak to this the most. She's been in the trenches with the dual credit intro class.
Yeah.
Do you see a big difference? Like, you've watched them like go through that, oh no, what have I done moment.
Absolutely. Yeah, the dual credit class is really interesting, and it always has been for those reasons. So there's definitely this, I have the awareness when I'm teaching these courses that they are used to doing things very differently than I'm used to teaching them or used to conducting my classroom, you know? So I think there is some shock there whenever they enter my class. I mean, in the most basic sense, they have to have a textbook for my class. A lot of their classes, they don't even have to have textbooks, or if they do, they're provided by the school system. You know, so that's always fun, spending the first few weeks lecturing while like half the students don't have their textbooks, which happens in college, but with these high school students, they don't expect that. I've had, you know, students in the dual credit course that have expressed to me that, oh, typically they're an A student and they have, you know, they're in the top 10% or whatever. So why am I not doing so well in your course? And I think it's just a lack of awareness of how different things can be in a college course than they are in a high school course.
Then you know, completely change their learning strategies and engagement with the material.
Yeah, for that reason, I think that's a great idea for students, that it can help prepare them for college. Mm-hmm.
I also run into this between the undergrad to grad. So I am overhearing the question, how long does the paper need to be from grad students? I'm like, as long as it needs to be, what are you talking about? I'm not counting your words.
I start to give them that in undergrad. They're like, how long does my methods section have to be for my research methods paper? And I was like, what's your topic? Because it really depends. How many measures do you have? How long are you going to talk about participants? Is this just a survey? Because then your procedure section is like a line. Is it an experiment? Well, then you might need to write a paragraph or two. and I will say, it's not necessarily, I mean, like at the college to grad level, there might be something there where we could probably be doing a little more.
Yeah.
But like the high school level, I can't blame a high school student who comes into a freshman 101 class and is just like completely culture shocked, because you go through 12 years of high school, like elementary school to middle school to high school, and it is the same. You get in a class, you sit down, you shut up, you listen to your teacher lecture, you do your homework every night. And then you get to college and your teacher's like, I'll see you in 2 days. Don't email me.
So it's not.
What do you think about it?
Yeah, in that situation, it's not a lack of metacognitive awareness, right? It's poor expectations, but honest expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think, I guess once they realize, like, I guess there's that, that's when that metacognition is likely to really come in. Like, do you recognize it? Do you start to understand, like, oh, wait, this stuff isn't working? Or you're like, nope, this is what's got me through 12 years of high school. This is what I'm going to keep doing. Or, you know, they've got to work with me. They've got to hold my hand the whole way, whether they're going to say it or not. But that's when that metacognition would really benefit, that they would kick. Maybe we should just do that, Thomas. We just start 101 students with like a, do you think we could drop metacognition on them like week one?
Probably. I mean, I was thinking about doing that journal. Maybe Alyssa and I can set up like,
yes, please,
get our tests and content aligned, and then we, yeah, can do like cross-state like metacog journal, like scholarship teaching and learning research.
Only journals.
With the gratitude journal type.
Ooh.
Other
yeah. Project.
Yeah.
I'm just going to have them journal through 101. How about that?
No tests, only journals.
Only journals.
I mean, if I could find a way that my colleagues wouldn't look at me weird and be like, I'm not doing tests anymore, in a heartbeat, I would be like, yes. They're like, but you got to give a final. I'm like, do I?
A lot of my colleagues don't give tests, but granted, a lot of my colleagues are not psychology professors, and psychology professors have this pressure that we got to assess in a certain way. But a lot of people at my college don't use finals or tests or anything of that nature. I'm like, oh, that must be a great life over there.
I would need something, though. I will say the tests help when the other stuff doesn't
exactly
work.
Yeah, exactly. No, I'm all the tests, but
the tests are a buffer. Well, we found some way to apply hot hand fallacy to this topic, which is great. I'm happy we could brainstorm on that, and I'll have to figure out what I'm gonna do next week, because I'm out of Kahneman and Tversky biases and we have one episode left.
Does this have to do with the supply chain shortage? Are we out? Can we not get it in any more Kahneman Tversky?
Yeah, we need to like import them in.
Ah!
From the European psychologists or something. I don't know. We'll figure it out. But with that, I thank you, Amanda, for joining us. Super interesting. This is going to help me. This entire season is going to help me. Because I'm teaching memory and cognition again in the spring. And so I'm going to be a better memory and cognitive teacher come spring, because I've been having nothing but deep dive conversations about memory, cognition, and everything in between. And at least maybe it'll help me think about thinking about that.
There you go.
So, but thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, you guys. I really enjoyed this.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, thank you so much.
This is fun.
Yeah, and with that, we'll bid our listeners adieu. Goodbye,
everybody. Good night.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.